For Kitchen Window, I'm Bonnie Wolf. Julie O'Hara is a freelance writer and recipe developer in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and she blogs at A Mingling of Tastes. She suffers from zucchini envy and has written about it for NPR's Kitchen Window Online. She joins me today. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Bonnie.
Is zucchini envy too strong?
I don't think so. Not at all. I mean, I actually suffer a lot of envy from anyone who can grow any fresh food in their own garden, because I live in a condo and I would love to have a garden someday and more zucchini than I know what to do with.
So where do you go to get your zucchini?
Usually I have to go to my local supermarket. If I can go to a farmer's market, I prefer that, because you'll find so many great varieties of summer squash at farmer's markets.
What's your favorite of the summer squashes?
I like the patty pans because they're cute.
They are adorable.
They're the little round ones with, you know, scallops, kind of a lacy edge, and they're just cute. But most of the time I eat zucchini.
Now, why of all the overabundance of summer produce is squash the one you focus on?
I focus on squash because people complain about it so much. Maybe I feel the need to champion it a little bit. And the reason they complain about it is because it's so prolific. You have a squash plant in your garden, you're going to have barrels and barrels of squash to last you all summer, and you're probably going to end up trying to give it away to friends and neighbors because it's more than you can use.
Why is it so prolific?
It just grows really easily. It's a happy plant. It's an ancient crop native to North America, and there's wild squash remains that date back to 7,000 BC, but it was domesticated in North America, and when the Native Americans migrated around North America, they took the squash with them, and it grew everywhere they planted it. It's just an easy crop to grow. It matures very quickly, so once you see the flowers on there, you're going to have a squash that's ready to pick in about a week.
Tell me about squash blossoms.
I love squash blossoms, and I didn't give any recipes for them because they're really hard to find. I rarely see them. If they're at a farmer's market, I'm thrilled, but they're hard to find unless you grow the plants yourself. And they're just the flower of the plant, and if it's a female squash blossom, it will turn into a squash, and if it's a male, it's there for pollination purposes, and you can pick the males and you can saute them in olive oil and toss them with pasta. You can stuff them with ricotta cheese. You can deep fry them. They're just delicious. They're an edible flower.
And yeah, talk about pretty.
Mm-hmm.
What are some other summer squashes that we may not be familiar with?
I love the eight ball squash. It's a great name, first of all,
yes.
Yeah, because it looks like, you know, a pool ball. Or sometimes they're called globe squash, and they're great for stuffing. And, I mean, just picture the presentation on that. You know, you can stuff it with sausage, ground meat, vegetables, top it off with cheese, and it's a great little main course. There are really pretty striated yellow squash, you know, like with yellow and green stripes. There's pale green ones that are just minty green and white. There are so many varieties, I hesitate to give names because you just, you know, go to your market and see what looks good and try it.
Saraya Mohammed, who is the producer of this podcast, was away on vacation for 9 days and came back to find giant zucchini in her garden. What should she do with them?
Oh, that is the perfect illustration of what can happen if you're not careful and vigilant about your squash, because they grow so quickly, and if they get too large, then they lose their tenderness and the soft texture. And you can either pick them off and use them, you know, sort of as compost, or, and this is probably a better option, you can grate them and use them in squash bread, muffins, or pancakes. I have a recipe for pancakes on Kitchen Window. And they're also good for stuffing and roasting. Because when they get large, the skin gets firm and the seeds get big, and they're not as tender and sweet as the young squash.
Well, in her defense, she did tell her house sitter to pick them when they were small, but apparently that didn't happen. So she'll be happy to hear this. One of the recipes that you use, I just loved. I had never thought of this, but it was to take a vegetable peeler and first peel the squash, but then use the vegetable peeler to make ribbons of squash to put in pasta, and I guess you could use it with other things.
Right. I love that technique, and it's great because there's no cooking involved unless you want there to be. But yeah, you just take the squash and you peel long ribbons along the length of the squash, and the texture you create is just great. It's got a little bit of toothsome crispness to it, but otherwise it's just this soft ribbon-like piece of squash. And you can toss it with pasta, you can toss it with olive oil and lemon just to make a salad, and it's beautiful. It's a beautiful presentation. It would be great as a bed for grilled fish, maybe. A million things you could do with it.
Maybe Soraya can use her big squash to do that. All right, Julie, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris. Barbecue is religion in Texas, and every 5 years, Texas Monthly Magazine goes on a quest to find the Holy Grail, the best barbecue in a state that reveres smoked meat. This year, the magazine dispatched 18 writers. They traveled nearly 15,000 miles and visited 341 establishments. In an unheard-of upset, a tiny cafe in central Texas beat out the longtime favorites to snatch first place. Then came the brisket-loving crowds, and as NPR's John Burnett reports, the little barbecue pit that could is strained to the breaking point.
It's about 11:15 on Friday night. We've built a fire in the firebox about an hour ago. At this time, we've got good heat on the pits that we're going to put our brisket on. Get them on and get all the lids closed and leave them alone for a couple hours.
A bandy-legged former rodeo clown and prison guard named Carrie Bexley is the owner of Snow's Barbecue. It's in the little town of Lexington, an hour's drive northeast of Austin. It only opens Saturday mornings. He and three employees arrive by 10 p.m. Friday to light the oak logs.
Heat about 250, 275 in there on them briskets. If I ain't got that, I ain't doing no good.
Barbecue requires heat, smoke, salt and pepper, and thyme. The alchemist of these ingredients is known as the pit master. Tootsie Tominetz has been cooking barbecue in Central Texas for 42 of her 73 years. She shows up at 2 a.m. like a Texas tornado.
Y'all just now putting them on fat side down? I don't want them fat side down.
Okay. Well, you want to leave them, flip them back?
Flip them back. I want fat side up all times.
Miss Tootsie, as she's respectfully called, tends the massive iron pits and hissing fireboxes like an admiral minding her fleet. Her gray hair is cut sensibly short. A blue apron is fastened around her waist. During the week, she works as a school custodian. On Saturday mornings, her strong arms turn short ribs and chicken halves, briskets and pork steaks with a practiced flip of the fork. Standing before the pits all night, she's enveloped in smoke. But like a beekeeper resistant to stings, it doesn't seem to bother her. She's all business.
It's 3:30, and we're thinking about getting ready to wrap them in foil. They've got a golden brown.
Time was when Miss Tootsie cooked mainly for locals, but then came the magazine article.
We were named number one in Texas, and that from that point on, our whole business has changed drastically. We have gone from cooking in the vicinity of 300 pounds to cooking in excess of 1,000 pounds. And last week, we sold out before 10 o'clock.
Owner Carrie Bexley says people now routinely drive to Snow's from across the state.
There's a gentleman called in this week from Fort Worth, and he ordered a half a pound of brisket, one link of sausage, and two ribs, and is going to drive from Fort Worth for that, and that just blows my mind. $4 a gallon gas, it's just hard to imagine how far people travel for barbecue.
Within Texas, the discovery of Snow's has been met with the excitement that elsewhere might greet the unearthing of an unknown Mayan city or the finding of an unfinished Hemingway manuscript. At Texas Monthly, executive editor Paul Burka is the magazine's final authority on the smoking arts.
My first reaction when I heard about Snow's was, this is impossible. It doesn't happen. There are no unknown great barbecue places in Texas. We've been doing this for years. I've driven all around, and particularly in a town of 1,000 people. It can't happen.
The most famous barbecue places in the state are well known. The perennial pantheon is Louis Mueller's in Taylor, Kreutz's in Smitty's in Lockhart, Cooper's in Llano, and City Market in Luling. And one of them has a century-old pit. So along comes Snow's, 5 years young. But they say the brisket that Tootsie Tominette smokes is almost indescribable.
I wrote that it was as soft and sweet as cookie dough. That was how I felt about it. It was almost transcended meat.
The price of fame has been high. Snow's was unprepared for the onslaught. The question for anxious barbecue lovers here is whether Miss Tootsie can take the pressure and maintain her quality.
It was a good article. It brought us into the daylight, but it has blown our business out of proportion. There's no time for relaxation. I mean, it's constantly on my toes to catch the next bit before it starts, and here we go.
With the radio keeping them company, the employees have wrapped the briskets in foil to keep them moist. They've made liberal use of Miss Tootsie's mop sauce, made of onions, mustard, butter, vinegar, and Worcestershire sauce. The sun has been up for a half hour now.
It's going on 7. We have mopped the pork ribs again. We've mopped the chickens. Things will be moving pretty quickly now.
With only an hour till opening, the focus of activity shifts indoors to the tiny dining room. Bexley's daughter, Larissa, has driven in from Texas A&M University, and his neighbor, a beautician named Phyllis Rogers, has also come in to serve.
Yeah, we're a pretty laid-back little town, and this is pretty incredible to have these people coming from all over the state and other states just to eat brisket. Of course, Miss Tootsie does a good job. She's had lots of practice. 43 years, that's a lot of briskets.
By 7:30, there are already 22 people lined up outside, not at all intimidated by the prospect of barbecue for breakfast. Erin Blake and her friends have driven over from Austin.
We heard about it from a friend of ours who said it was the best barbecue in Texas, and we had to come out here and see if it's really true.
At 8 o'clock, Carrie Bexley checks to be sure they have enough potato salad, coleslaw, and white bread, and unlocks the door.
Heard a man.
Thank y'all again.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, good morning.
Can we get 1.5 pounds of the brisket, 1 pound of the steak pork,
okay,
and 1 pound of the ribs and a sausage wrap?
On this morning, Snow's Barbecue will sell out in about an hour. Some frustrated out-of-towners will climb back in their cars and vow to return next week even earlier. Miss Tootsie will worry that there's not enough barbecue left for her local customers, who she's been serving for decades. So if you're curious about Snow's, do her a favor and forget you ever heard this story. John Burnett, NPR News, Austin.
1 pound of the pork steak.
1 pork steak?
Yes, sir. And 1 pound of ribs and a sausage wrap.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition. From NPR News, I'm Leanne Hansen. Every year, Americans reach for more and more wine. Last year, we drank enough to set a record for the nation, 304 million cases. We even surpassed Italians for the first time. That's thanks in part to the growing variety of wines. On our show last week, we asked accredited sommelier Natalie McLean to help us pair those wines with our favorite foods, like nachos.
A simple, berry-ripe red wine like a California Zinfandel.
This week, we continue our conversation with McLean about wine. She says the drink is changing as demand increases, but change isn't necessarily bad news.
The good news today is that there is so much competition around the world between new producers of wine, new regions. The new technology is allowing winemakers to make better wine at lower prices. And all of that means that we don't have to pay a lot of money anymore for delicious wine. Now, we're always going to pay super premium prices for brand name regions like Bordeaux, you know, your cult California Cabernets at the highest end, Burgundy, and so on. But if you look at value regions like South Africa, lesser known regions of California, Chile, Argentina, you're going to find spectacularly delicious wines in the $10 to $15 range.
Really?
Really. A lot of the value-priced wines, as they'd have us say it, are made to be consumed immediately. In fact, you know, most wines are consumed within about 17 minutes of purchase, the time it takes to drive home. So winemakers know that. 99% of wines today are not meant to be aged. So the wine style today is accessible, it's fruity, it's delicious, it's consistent, and it's cheap.
Is alcohol percentage a factor?
Yeah, alcohol affects wine profoundly. These days, wines on average seem to be getting higher and higher in their alcohol level. Some say it's global warming. Others just say that it's the market driving the wine style. People want more bang for their buck. So the winemakers are letting the grapes hang longer on the vines. That translates into more sugar in the grapes. Sugar is what makes alcohol.
Hmm.
In the old days, 10 years ago, maybe 10-12% was average for alcohol level. Now we're seeing 13-16%. I actually am very sensitive to that because when wines get that high in alcohol, the heat of the alcohol starts to overwhelm the other flavor elements in it.
You made an aside to climate change, perhaps affecting the increasing alcohol percentages. Do you find that climate change is affecting the wine industry in other ways? Are observations being made?
Absolutely. I was in Germany in September, and Germany is renowned for its ethereal, delicate Rieslings. They are usually or traditionally have been in the 7 to 9% alcohol range. But what's happening is that the alcohol levels are going up, but also there are no longer bad vintages, bad meaning the grapes didn't ripen enough or there was, you know, just too much rain. So overall, the vintages are getting riper. There's more sun, more warming of the grapes, and so on.
What about buying locally and organically? How do you go about finding something good?
Well, organic wines, for starters, are very well made these days. A lot of us still have the image of the bad old 70s when organic wines were
lighter fluid.
Yeah, exactly, if that. But these days, organic wines have to compete on taste. People buy primarily on taste and price. So I'm finding that the organic wines I taste these days are extremely well made. So the organic wine section of the liquor store is also one of the fastest growing. It's growing by 20% a year. I think there are some misperceptions about organic wines, that they're somehow a more healthful beverage. They are not, because fermentation takes care of all the pesticides. But when you buy organic wines, you're making a statement both for the environment and those who work on that winery, which is essentially a grape farm. Buying local is also a great thing. I mean, you know, there again, you're making a statement about the environment. It's supporting your local farmers. And, you know, there's so many pockets of great wineries, you know, these days, from Texas to Michigan to upper New York State. It's a great reason to explore what's in your own backyard.
Two quick fire questions. Favorite wine?
Oh, my goodness, the one someone else pays for. But
That's good. That's a great answer. Great okay. answer. All right, here's the other one. Which country produces the best wine?
Oh, you know, I'm a fan of Pinot Noir worldwide. So I love it from cool regions of California, Carneros, Russian River. I love it from Oregon. I love it from Burgundy. I'm such a fan of Pinot Noir, and it's becoming a cliche. I've got to, you know, redo my wine wardrobe. Ever since Sideways. It's old news, but I love the seductiveness of Pinot Noir. It packs so much flavor, and yet it's not heavy. Anyway.
I thought you were going to be diplomatic and say the country you're in. You know, when you drink. I mean, look, Natalie, give me a break. You have this book, Red, White, and Drunk All Over. You take us all around the world of wine. Mm. In your wildest dreams, did you ever think you'd make a living drinking wine and writing about it?
No, although I think everybody who starts into this business, whether you're writing about food or wine, comes in through a back door somehow. And it's about discovering a passion that you always thought would be a hobby. The people in this industry who make wine, they are often refugees from another industry. They too have found their passion, whether they're sommeliers or winemakers or retailers or whatever. And it's not just another product. I mean, you know, there's a reason we don't have orange juice critics. There's something in that glass that combines the hedonism, the sensuality, and the sheer buzz of it to make it something we love to talk about, write about, and of course, drink.
You're reminding me of the song Wine Fodiote. Sommelier Natalie McLean is the author of Red, White, and Drunk All Over. She spoke to us from the studios of the CBC in Ottawa. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Leanne. Cheers.
In New York, a new city law is requiring chain restaurants to post the calorie counts of all their menu items. If you don't do it by midnight tonight, you can get fined. NPR's Robert Smith went out this morning to see how New Yorkers are dealing with the new caloric reality.
It's hard enough standing in line at Starbucks in the morning, you're bleary-eyed, the line is long here in New York City, but now at least there's something you can do while you're waiting. You can look at all of the different calorie counts, and you can even play the calorie count game. I'm here with Chantel Henry from Brooklyn.
Yes.
What do you think has more calories, the banana nut loaf or the rainbow cookie?
Banana.
The banana nut loaf actually does have 460 calories, yes. And the rainbow cookie 420 calories.
Mm-hmm.
Does this change the way you shop? Does this change what you buy at Starbucks every morning?
Yes. I just will cut down a little, because I usually have Starbucks every day.
She looks so bummed out that I don't point out that her caramel frappuccino is 380 calories. So I go across the street to McDonald's, and I run into a very trim...
Ronnie Hansen from Bergenfield, New Jersey.
You're here at McDonald's. What did you have for breakfast?
Oh, yeah. What did I have? A McMuffin.
Now, the surprising thing when you actually see the McDonald's menu is that the Egg McMuffin, which is the symbol of terrible fast food morning breakfast, is in fact
the least amount. I noticed that.
It is the lowest calorie thing on the menu.
I know, because I was going to get the burritos, and they were higher, and I said, I'm going to go with the Egg McMuffin.
So already this is changing your behavior. On just the first day they're doing this, it's changing your behavior.
Sure. Definitely. I'm definitely looking to make sure I don't put on extra weight.
Come on. On your birthday, do you want someone to serve you a slice of birthday cake and say, oh, by the way, happy birthday, it's 782 calories?
No, but if you don't want to know, you don't have to look.
That is the strategy employed by Lonnie General, sitting at the next table. He's eating...
steak, egg, and cheese breakfast meal.
Did you even look at how many calories that is up there?
Nope. Don't care.
Well, luckily I wrote it down. That's 660 calories. That's one of the highest calorie items on the entire menu.
Well, I'll take a bite out of that.
Is it delicious? Is it sinfully delicious?
Yes, it is. The government needs to mind its own damn business. Let people live their life the way they want to live their life. In a nutshell.
For those New Yorkers who don't want a shot of nutritional reality in the morning, there is an alternative, a loophole in the law. You see, it only applies to chain restaurants. If you're a mom-and-pop independent store, you do not have to post the calorie counts. So you can do what I did this morning, which was, when the line at Starbucks was too long, I went over to my local coffee cart. I'd like a regular cup of coffee, cream and sugar, and a raisin bran muffin.
Sure.
Do you know how many calories are in that bran muffin?
I don't know.
You don't know?
No.
So I should just eat it and be happy?
Yeah. Just like take the donuts, I'm going to happy.
I guess it's truly a guilt-free breakfast. Robert Smith, NPR News in Times Square.